Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we look at the proposed new ballot measure that's gathering signatures right now that would take money from high-speed rail and direct it to build new dams and expand existing ones here in Central California. Is that measure a water grab, or is it a lifeline to the valley? We'll talk to the backers of that proposal later on in our show. Also, local theater with Donald Monroe of the Fresno Bee. We'll talk about what's happening on the theatrical stage here in Central California. Plus, our series on the mayoral candidates in Fresno continues with Doug Vagum. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the race for U.S. Senate. California law prohibits felons, people with a history of domestic violence, and others with severe mental illness from having guns. It falls to Attorney General Kamala Harris and her Department of Justice to confiscate those guns. Harris is now running for U.S. Senate, and as KQED's Julie Small reports, as part of our California Counts election coverage, some 12,000 people banned from having guns still have them anyway.
In 2001, a gunman in Nevada City shot and killed 19-year-old Laura Wilcox while she was working at the county behavioral health clinic. Her mother, Amanda Wilcox, cannot forget the shock of it.
I was numb for 6 months. I mean, it turned your life upside down.
Eventually, shock gave way to a conviction that Amanda and her husband Nick must do more to control access to guns. Now they're pushing to fully fund a program run by California's Department of Justice, or DOJ, called the Armed and Prohibited Persons System, also known as APPS.
Implementing the program's harder than we all envisioned, I think, certainly for DOJ and certainly for us who advocated for this program in the very beginning.
APPS is a database used to flag gun owners who lose the right to have firearms. Agents at the Department of Justice track them down and confiscate their guns. But from day one, there's been a backlog in the system.
Senator Steinberg, Senator Anderson.
At a public safety hearing, legislators were stunned when Bureau of Firearms Chief Stephen Lindley testified that California's list of prohibited gun owners had reached 20,000. It's still growing.
Despite our best efforts, the Bureau does not have the funding or resources to keep up with this annual influx of cases to reduce the backlog.
Senator Daryl Steinberg threw his support behind the APPS program.
How many people? How many guns? What would it cost to get them out of the hands of prohibited people as quickly as possible?
Lindley told lawmakers if the Bureau could hire 50 more agents temporarily, they would be able to clear the backlog within 3 years. Lawmakers approved a one-time allocation of $24 million. But after an event at the state capitol this week, Attorney General Kamala Harris said the money was not enough to get the job done.
The Armed and Prohibited Persons List is extensive, and it grows every day. It's not just some list that sits there, and we just chip away at it. Every day, names are added to that list, and I need a lot more resources, frankly.
In a report to the legislature, Harris's department said they've cleared 20,000 cases since 2013, but also added 20,000. They've declined to talk with us about the report. Republican Senator Jim Nielsen says Harris and the DOJ are making excuses.
They have not made it a priority. It's as simple as that.
Nielsen voted for the temporary funding back in 2013. Now he's calling for a hearing to find out why DOJ did not eliminate the backlog.
Their answer is, we need more money. We need more money. We need more money. That is not an answer.
A 2015 report by the Bureau of State Audits faulted the DOJ for redirecting APPS agents to other work and for not doing enough to ensure the accuracy of the database. Some responsibility lies with local law enforcement for failing to notify DOJ when they confiscate guns. California Police Chiefs Association's President David Bejarano says initially a lot of police and sheriffs were not fully aware of the program.
I think there's a refocus to spend more time using the database, and we've seen an improvement.
Nick Wilcox, whose daughter Laura was shot to death, says APPS would be even more effective if California fully funds it.
In an ideal world, they would be disarming these prohibited persons as soon as they became known to DOJ so that you're not always feeling like you're on a treadmill going backwards.
The legislature will consider the Attorney General's request for more money to confiscate guns at a hearing in Sacramento today. But even with more funding, the DOJ projects that it will take until 2020 to reduce the backlog to 3,000 people. I'm Julie Small in San Francisco.
That story was part of our California Counts election coverage in collaboration with KPCC, Capital Public Radio, and KPBS. You'll find more stories online at kvpr.org. This is Valley Edition. All this month, we're talking to the candidates running for mayor of Fresno. The race to lead California's fifth largest city recently gained a new name, at least a new name in the sense of a new contestant in the race, but not a new name to Valley voters or people who are involved in local politics. And that's longtime community activist, government watchdog, and former county supervisor Doug Vagum, who joins us in our studio today. Doug, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks. It's good to be here, and I appreciate you inviting me in.
Doug, your time in being involved in public service or being involved as a government watchdog goes back 50 years. In fact, you started out with your dad leading the campaign to save the old Fresno County Courthouse, which was torn down 50 years ago this year.
That's right. I was just out of high school. The issue of tearing down a courthouse and building a new one or getting a rehab money to fix it up was a high controversy in this community, and there was a big movement to save it. My father led the fight and joined by a very active group of people who really, really rolled up their sleeves as a grassroots organization to try to save that. I saw grassroots firsthand. I was amazed. Rallies on the courthouse steps, the works. I helped, some of the lawyers that were working with the committee to save the courthouse do things like run copy machines and everything else, just the old-fashioned grassroots politics. Unfortunately, the people's will was there. The board was set to get the money, and the courts were set to have a new playground for themselves to have a courtroom in. So they ruled against, even though the people actually voted to not tear down the courthouse, the courts overruled them, believe it or not, and said, well, you have to lose that $1 million because of that $1 million that you had back then was a lot of money. You will not be able to get that money because it was only for new construction, which I think somebody was making, inventing things. The board decided, well, we need that $1 million, so we're going to vote to tear it down anyway. And the courts basically said, we have a right to order you to build a new courthouse because we feel unsafe. They actually said that. So that's the trail of tears for that courthouse.
Is that what led you to pursue public service and eventually serving on the Board of Supervisors? I mean, why get into this line of work?
Well, it got my mind wrapped around it. And the fact that I saw activism as a younger person, and I also saw local politics flare up. And as a matter of fact, when that courthouse was torn down, and most people commented it took a lot longer and it was a much more tougher building to tear down, much more impressionable to the people who watched it and photographed it, such as the Fresno Bee, who basically documented it through photography, found that it wasn't such a easy little crumbling building as they once thought. So every board member on that county board of supervisors then got voted out of office in the two different elections that came back-to-back within the 2 years of that courthouse being torn down. Actually, 2 years, and then another 2 years after that, the rest of the board was swept out of office. So the people were mad. They were steamed. As a matter of fact, that created the whole movement, I believe, in a statewide preservation that actually helped preserve the state capitol. It started that movement. And from that point, they went ahead and sold bonds to preserve that state capitol, which in a way, I guess, is a wonderful and befitting epitaph for that courthouse to be lost, that we saved our state capitol because it is such a beautiful building.
So you were involved in that fight. You've led other fights as well.
Oh,
most
absolutely.
Recently, the effort to critique, eventually to take to the voters the Measure W, which never got to the voters in its final form. But the city of Fresno's city of Fresno's drinking water treatment plans, massive spending. You've seen it from both the
perspective of being a legislator on the Board of Supervisors. You've also seen it from this activist perspective. Which do you prefer? Now you're running for mayor. Which are you more comfortable with?
I think bringing a change at any level in government is good. And I think a fundamental change, and I don't mean a fundamental change that puts everything upside down. I'm talking about a fundamental change that brings activism into the office, activism for the people. The people deserve to have people in office that think of them first, not second. I believe currently in government, in too many places, that people come after as an afterthought of government satisfying and fixing itself, and then we'll see what it does to the people. That is the wrong way to approach this. I firmly believe in going way back, even from the courthouse all the way moving up to the point where I led fights, one to preserve the tennis courts at Roding Park. At one time, they wanted to tear them out and put a different type of venue there. They wanted to start charging people for using them. I began the process of creating a movement that we saved them. We got new courts. We got federal money. And they're sitting there today as beautiful as ever. They need some, I say TLC, but they're there and they're wonderful. And the fact that all the way up, including the Measure G, which is the solid waste removal, I even though the labor folks were the most active, I have started the movement basically by saying, you can do it. They felt that they couldn't do it. I said, yeah, you can do it. Let's go do it. And so they woke up that sleeping giant and they went and I helped and I did as much as I could and as anyone, I believe, to get out there to change the minds of the people that that was not a good deal. It was a bad deal for the people of Fresno. And then the water fight was another issue that we can go into if you want.
We certainly will. Okay. If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with former County Supervisor Doug Vagum, who's running to be Fresno's next mayor. He has a long tradition of being a government watchdog on a number of different issues, from water to solid waste and other things. You also, though, served on the county board. What did you learn being on the other side of the equation, being in government?
Well, the first thing I learned, Joe, is that when you get an office that's overwhelming to any person, young or old, And then it wants to take you over, and it wants to adapt you, basically like the Borg, so to speak. You know, it's futile to fight. You're going to be taken over by government, and you're going to think like a government think. That's something I resisted every minute I was in there, and I thought of the people first. And often enough, you can't believe how much you agitate everybody inside government when you're thinking of the people first. How dare you? You're getting in our way. No, people come first. How does it affect them? That's my first thought in my mind. And when you look at that, what it's going to cost them, how it's going to, what the regulation is going to do to them, what's the unintended consequences, all ought to be put up on top of the shelf, not on the bottom of the shelf. And that's my approach to anything I do when I get in office, and that's what I did in my 8 years on the county board.
So let's go ahead and start moving forward to the present day and more, even more importantly, the future. Your vision for City Hall. I think when people think of your name most recently in the news, it's what you're opposed to or a different project that you have a concern about the way government is approaching a particular issue. What is your agenda moving forward as wanting to set the agenda for a city that's the fifth largest in California?
Well, on the water situation, it wasn't necessarily opposed to. It was a better way to do it. And the only way to say is to before they got themselves into the wrong step, a foot in the bucket, so to speak, and they couldn't move out of what they did wrong, we had to stop them. And the only way to stop them is to go out and get people to sign petitions and show that there's sufficient enough people that are concerned that we could put something on the ballot. That's when we started talking about settlements. And by the way, as an outcome of that, everyone's water rates are 33% lower than they were back in 2013 when they first issued those rates. And collectively, you could probably say there's tens of millions of dollars saved out of the pocketbooks of the people of this community. And the city was able to still do what they wanted to do, I think is a better approach even still. Now, what would you do as an advocate versus a anti position of something that they did wrong? You want to go off on the right foot? Believe me, there are plenty of ways to approach a lot of the problems that I believe is they're starting off on the wrong foot. I believe, for example, the housing issue. The project at the South Stadium project is one issue that I have a big concern about. That's one of the latest projects. They're spending tens of millions of dollars worth of public housing money, giving land and building buildings away that they bought for over $1 million just a few years ago for $1 each. Okay, that's $3 for about $1 million worth of land and buildings. They get about $4 to $6 million worth of housing money for 50 units. And the balance is going to be leveraged by the city's own giveaway, which is value, has some value, and the matching funds by some housing and federal funds to go float a bond for special housing bond that will be leveraged by public money. The developer's only into it 10%. So if the developer says, I can't make this work, the people are stuck now paying the bills like Granite Park, like Met Museum, like the baseball stadium, picking up the tab if that project doesn't work. My point is that's tens of millions of dollars that could go to hundreds of homes that are in a disadvantaged situation right now. That money can go anywhere, that housing funds. That's city housing funds that they've collected from various sources. They're putting a big chunk of it on 50 units.
They are, and city officials would say that that's a strategic way to attract more investment to downtown. And also the thought is that putting all affordable housing units in one part of the city or putting development that's only affordable housing units maybe doesn't have the best outcomes. So it's better to mix those uses.
My point is you don't have to put it all in one spot. There's plenty of disabled and dilapidated units that we're starting to read about in the code enforcement issues. Those qualify if they have income levels in them, and most of them do, for that type of money. Why not put the city has done that in the past. Why not start doing it again to help those folks that have those units that the code enforcement guys are writing up get some of that money to fix those units up? No, it's being driven into one magic bullet project. The mayor came into this office, and I think she's done a job that she really earnestly believes in, and there's going to be some positives out of that, but there's some, I believe, negatives. And one of the negatives is you're going to have a lot of units in a place that you don't know in the long term if those units are going to stay the way they are, or they're basically going to be taken over by the housing authority and run as true only low and income and moderate income units. By the way, the law has changed. The units down in the south end of the mall, the income level for qualifications to get into one of those is all down to 50% of poverty, which means some of those units will be like 300 to 400 if they fill up 20% of every one of those projects downtown has to be set for low and mild income folks. I don't know how many are actually in there. That's public information, and I hope we can get that information to see really how many low and mod income people are really in those units, because 20% have to be set aside. That's 10 units in that 50-unit project downtown. The law changed to the fact that people now can come in at 50% of poverty, 50% below the poverty level, and be qualified for that unit, get subvention money, and the unit can't rent for any more than like $400 a month. So I don't know how many of those are going to go that way, and I don't know how much they have to make up the difference for the rest of the units, for the private guy to be able to pay off those bonds that he's going to go float. Those questions have not been answered, and they're not in the reports. My point is, if you're going to do that stuff, make it available front so everybody understands.
Well, the pro formas for that project actually are available publicly. The most expensive market rate units go for about $1,700, and the affordable units, the 10 of those rent between, I believe, $500 and $600. But that's beside the point. We can go back and forth on numbers all
and
day.
But the $500 to $600 is for the low and mod, and you qualify as much as low as 50% of poverty.
Let's go ahead and move on to another issue. You just mentioned code enforcement. This is an issue that all of the candidates are talking about. It was really brought to the fore this past year with the Somerset Village Apartments. I think most people who are have been paying attention to this issue realize this is not something that just popped up overnight, and that there are probably more Somerset Village type developments out there that are in very poor condition, substandard, many code violations. Yet the city over the last few years has cut its code enforcement department. There's talk about bringing more resources to the fore there. How do you address something like that? Is it simply more dollars going to code enforcement, or is there a different way? How would a Doug Vegam administration address and prevent a Somerset Village from happening?
Well,
in the future?
Well, first of all, coming from grassroots, I've learned that there are positive energy in a lot of active groups, and you need to work and take that positive energy and create a much more a boomerang effect that basically that allows you to get that synergy moving. And I would reach out to all those groups. Look, when I did Measure W, I reached out to every spectrum you could think of to bring people together in a collaborative that we got energy out of that. I would bring that same energy to the mayor's office. And we need to do that on many fronts, not just code enforcement. The activities and playgrounds and that type of stuff, which is another issue. I put on youth tennis programs when we put the new courts in the Roding Park. Was an offshoot of putting on a citywide junior tennis program everywhere from West Fresno, Northeast and Northwest Fresno, and Southeast Fresno, all over this community. We put a program on that was sponsored by the National Link, a program that Arthur Ashe started. Those programs are gone. We've lost our youth programs. We've lost our playground activities. They used to have a cooperative arrangement with the city schools. Matter of fact, we used to put our tennis programs on city school tennis courts. They're gone. For whatever reason, they were lost. A lot of liability issues and those types of things created that environment where the city had to pull back. We can do it again, and I will do that again. And back to the pro forma thing, just for a second on South Stadium. When you read that, Joe, there wasn't a true pro forma in there. They really didn't. As a matter of fact, they violated the Better Business Ordinance because there was more than $2 million worth of city money in that project. They devalued what they gave to the what they paid versus what they gave. They said, well, the value now isn't as worth as much as what we paid for it, so it's less than $2 million. Honestly, if it was over that money, the threshold of Better Business Act, they would have had to do a full analysis as a prospectus on that project. They did not do that.
Let's go back to Somerset Village, though. Aside from engaging these different grassroots groups, those grassroots groups don't necessarily have the power to levy fines and other things and forcing city codes. This problem is obviously is something that's not isolated. It's not just one complex, and it has grown over the years. There's not only out-of-town property owners, but also local property owners that have some of these issues that are out there. What would a Vagim administration do on code enforcement and preventing one of those situations?
You work collaboratively with those folks.
The community groups or the owners?
Well, the community groups are your watchdogs. They will tell you where the problems are. Okay, now, you need to have a constant and, let's say, flow of this is what we're going to do. And the owners are being brought into the loop. You don't just charge them like an army. You make them aware that they are there's problems. We need to start getting to those problems. You do it in a process of a collaborative way with a watchdog independent groups, the grassroots organizations, and the owners are brought into the mix. There are plenty of substandard units out here that you can find in any drive down, any neighborhood, and you can say, wait a minute, come on, mow the lawn, do something. And when I was in the middle of a Measure W fight, I urged the city to put some funds away through some process to help people retrofit their turf and their garden sprinkling system so we could actually have less water use but a better environment on the gardens. They didn't do that. So what people do, they turned everything off, and you walk around neighborhoods in the middle of the summer and they're dying lawns and dying gardens, and that's a shame. It really actually lowered, I think, the perspectives of the city as an attractive community.
Let's move along to some other issues here. One that all the other candidates are also talking about is homelessness. You have a variety of different solutions out there. Henry Perea was on our program last week. He says he thinks the city needs to consider establishing emergency shelters, essentially legalized encampments, where the city would provide porta potties and other facilities, but would allow people who either aren't ready to get into supportive housing or aren't willing to go through the types of treatment programs that some of the other shelters and things mandate, for those people to get them off the street, saying you can't live behind Vons anymore. What do you think about that, and what would a Vagim administration do on homelessness?
Well, first of all, Fresno County, let me just step back from that.
Sure.
Mental health is 90% of what we have in folks out there. They have most of them are either dual diagnosed with the mental health and a drug and abuse program or something like that. Frankly, a lot of those folks don't really realize that they are in such bad shape. They don't realize they're out on the streets, and they need some assistance. Fresno County is one of the lowest per capita funded counties in the state of California for mental health funds. When I was on the county board, as a matter of fact, I believe Supervisor Perea, my predecessor, or his predecessor, Susan Anderson, the three of us all happened to have served our time on the board, on the Mental Health Advisory Board. That's one position for a county board of supervisor member on that board. I believe from there I learned a lot about the mental health program that found that we were so underfunded that we at the time took the state of California to court to say, look, how come you're giving San Francisco three times per capita the money when they're about the same size as Fresno County? That doesn't make any sense. There are counties like San Mateo that get twice as much money as we do. Santa Cruz County gets almost as much money as we do. That's why Santa Cruz is able to spend $8,000 per homeless person. That's why when you drive into Santa Cruz, you don't see people hanging around the fountain and that type of stuff anymore. They have a program that takes care of that. We don't have that type of funds. We need to get to the state and say, as a mayor, even though the county does it, you can join with the county and be a big soapbox to say, state, we need more funds. The legislature has the privilege, unfortunately, that's what the court says, to make their mind where they want to send the money. Why the court said that, we don't understand it. But we did get some more money when we did file a lawsuit. But we need to do that again to heighten the awareness of the state of California that Fresno County is in need. Now, what do you do with that money? The encampment programs are interesting. The problem is they become their own little cities. Like we found, they actually had a mayor of those cities. Did you know that? And to become mayor is to walk up at the back of the next previous mayor and bang him over the head with a 2x4. That actually happened. I talked to some of those people. That's how a mayoral change in the city on that old overpass that they used to, well, I forgot what they called that, was a Broadway overpass or something. The fact that you have to have some places, and we do. Fresno County, through its programs, through social services programs, there isn't one person that should be on the streets. You can go get a voucher for a motel right now. Within 15 minutes, you can go get a voucher if you can prove up that you're an indigent. They'll give you a voucher. They'll give you a food, a WIC card or one of those cards that replace food stamps. And sign you up for Medi-Cal if you're a brand new entity in the system in a matter of a day, okay? There's no excuse. The problem is those people don't want to be within four walls. They don't like the structure. If they were rich and they had a backpack and some granola bars and they would be on the John Muir Trail, we call them, boy, those guys are they're adventure-type people. They're the same folks, but they just don't have the ability to know what's happening. We need to reach out with, one, a concept of a team concept. We need to bring a law enforcement and mental health folks together. The city's trying to do that. We need to do more of it. And find a place for those folks to either feel comfortable in, whether it's an encampment like Mr. Perea is talking about, which I would like to see a lot more about before I get comfortable with that, or put them in a place that allows them to be in some of the – like for example, the downtown shelters, the two programs that are down there right now receive people at any time you want to come in. Like any one of those folks can come and knock on their door and walk in right now, and they'll put them in there. We need to get more active with those folks. And they're down there. They have open arms. They seem to be out of the equation. No one's bringing them up anymore. And I'd like to reach out to them and start working with them closer. Pastor Archie and those folks down there do wonderful work, and we need to reach out to them also.
Before we go, in just the last few minutes here, public safety is the other thing that everyone is talking about. Voters, candidates, is it just as simple as hiring more cops? Does that work in today's environment, both financially for the city, and does it achieve the results, especially when the mayor doesn't necessarily control the Fresno County Jail or state policies regarding things like prison realignment, Prop 47, other things that are out there that are going on? What would a Mayor Vagum do on public safety in last few minutes?
Well, first of all, the justice system is a holistic system. It begins with an arrest all the way up to a prosecution and a defense. You can't just load one system, part of the system up and expect it to move just flowing just wonderfully when you backlog it up somewhere in the middle. The fact that you do have an issue of services that are going or calls that are going on service because they're less priority is an issue. We need to figure out ways, and even the police folks, the rank and file representatives have said, look, we're not opposed to consolidation of various services, such as a helicopter and other services. And we need to reach out to the county and start working together to bring some of those together. We can free up funds for hiring more police officers. You just can't go out and say, I'm going to go get 1,000 PD folks and put them on the street. Where's the money? I'll tell you where the money is, through consolidation and those other efforts and working in more conjunctive ways together on those ancillary services and community policing. If I had the ability, put actually more precincts in this community, not less precincts.
You mentioned consolidation. Are you calling for revisiting the effort to consolidate Fresno County sheriffs and police?
Not to the same degree that they were once talking about. I'm talking about consolidating a lot of those ancillary services and even Jackie Parks even mentioned 2 years ago in the budget session in front of council. We're not opposed to that type of thing. But for some reason, the powers want to keep control and they don't want to loosen the reins. I would push to loosen those reins and work with the folks out on the streets. That's the folks in the blue and the folks in the brown, to how we can make those things work better.
The city's talking about building a new headquarters for the police and fire department potentially downtown. Is that something you'd be behind there, or is that maybe something to revisit now if you would potentially consolidate with the county?
Well, you have a communication center already set up by the Fresno Police, which is a big watch unit, and some people are very concerned if our social media and stuff is being accessed to a degree that's way beyond the Fourth Amendment. The fact that if it is, that the Fresno sheriff also has the same problem. But all these years, we still, even though they're using the same computer system, they still are using independent computer systems, and they have to cross-channel and do a double check to get over to each other's channel to see what's happening between sheriff and the PD. The fact that the jail records and all arrest records that went in and out of jail are kept by the sheriff and the PD have to come in on a secondary channel, on a second step to get into it, that all has to change. We have to marry that up and merge those services so they're all one and they're seamless. So I think it'll make more efficient law enforcement, and perhaps we can get better bang for the buck for every officer that's out on the street.
Former Fresno County Supervisor Doug Vagum is also a local government watchdog. He hopes to take that watchdog nature to City Hall and is a candidate for the mayor of Fresno in the June primary. Doug, thank you so much for joining us today.
Joe, thank you for having us. It's been great.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn more about the effort to take money from the high-speed rail project and put it towards water storage. It does a lot more than that. Some people are saying it goes too far. We'll hear from one of the backers coming up next. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It was just 2 years ago that California voters approved a water bond that set aside billions to pay for new water storage. Now a new group backed by many of the Valley's most influential farmers says that's not enough to build new dams like Temperance Flat and expand existing ones. They want to ask voters in November to approve a plan to take the $10 billion in bond funds that have been approved for high-speed rail and direct them to water projects. As you might expect, the plan is a controversial one, which some Bay Area groups are calling a, quote, water grab by the San Joaquin Valley. So what exactly would this measure do if it makes it on the ballot and is approved by California voters? Aubrey Betancourt is the executive director of the group that's helping to collect the signatures, the California Water Alliance. She joins us on the phone from Sacramento. Aubrey, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Like a lot of ballot measures, yours is kind of complicated. You're starting out essentially canceling the high-speed rail project and shifting those bond dollars to water projects. But it doesn't stop there, so let's take this piece by piece, starting with the existing money for high-speed rail. Where does that go? What exactly are you proposing be done with those funds?
Sure. Well, you have to remember that high-speed rail passed in 2008, I believe it was, is sitting on $8 billion that it's not using. It's having trouble with its alignments and a number of other problems as that project continues to develop. And in the meantime, we have a much more pressing infrastructure need in our state with regards to water. And so what this initiative proposes is taking those $8 billion of unissued bonds that the high-speed rail is not using and cannot have access to because of lack of development on that project, and shifting it over to be used for developing new water projects and new water supply throughout the state. The high-speed rail authority stays in place, but it's left in place with access to the funding that it does already, in order to try to finish its EIRs and EISs and get itself straightened out. But in the meantime, what this initiative, the Water Priorities Initiative, is proposing is that money can be used in a new for a higher priority of use, which is really addressing our water crisis and infrastructure from a water standpoint.
So one of the criticisms of high-speed rail is it's not meeting the goals that were established back in 2008 when voters approved that bond. It was very specific. It had to do certain things. What specifically would your ballot measure do when it comes to constructing new water storage?
Absolutely. So what this initiative does is it slides that funding over, combines it with some previously approved water bond funding that was sold to the voters as being for water supply expansion. And it delineates that fund for specific water projects, specifically build Sites Reservoir in the Sac Valley, build Temperance Flat Reservoir in the Mid-Sierras, raise Shasta Reservoir, and raise San Luis Reservoir. In addition, there's about $3 billion for groundwater recharge and aquifer protection, another couple billion dollars for upgrading our existing infrastructure, which desperately needs to be brought into the 21st century. And that leaves about $5 billion for regional water project development like stormwater capture and wastewater treatment and recycling to help develop and expand regional supply so as to free up and create flexibility on our large-scale supply as well. So what our initiative does is it provides specific outlines for what that funding is used for and to what specific projects so that it does get built and gets done as opposed to going through an application process or a long drawn-out process. This is very specific. It's dollars in, dollars to that project, get the project going and get it built for California.
So you mentioned the water bond. Your initiative also makes big changes there, and this was just approved by voters 2 years ago. That was a big coalition moment in California politics, a sort of rare opportunity. You saw Democrats, Republicans, farmers, environmental groups all working to push this bond, and they kind of had an agreed framework of how that would work. They set up this board that would oversee these projects, as you said, a competitive process. It's not enough to fund any one of those dams by themselves. Why the necessity to blow that up, essentially, at this point and start over?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it blowing it up. You have to remember that that Prop 1 water bond was over $7 billion bond, and all that we're asking access to with this initiative is $2.7 billion of that. That $2.7 billion was part of that Prop 1, and it was said to be used for developing new water supply. But unfortunately, in Prop 1, it didn't explain that that water supply did not have to go for drinking water. It could be any project associated with existing projects. And it provided very little structure for what that money was supposed to be used for specifically, and instead created this very complicated application process where now, like you just said, there's not enough money to go around and invest. It's having to compete between all valid and good projects that the state needs, like groundwater storage, groundwater protection, above-ground storage. And so what our initiative does is it rolls that 2.7 over, which was intended for developing supply, for instance, groundwater or above-ground surface, combines it with the high-speed rail dollars, and dedicates it that fund to being administered by a panel of state water experts elected regionally to represent 100% of the state and 100% of the state population, as opposed to its current administering board, which is done on governor appointees on the Water Commission. More importantly, it requires that this new authority, who are, like I said, water project managers, administer that fund fairly. There's no new cost to the taxpayer, and as soon as the fund has been administered, this authority goes away. So it's all about expediting the process and making sure that our priorities are straight. Under Prop 1, that $2.7 billion cannot be given to projects until 2018. We voted on that back in 2014, like you said. And so, again, this goes to how can we address and invest in upgrading our infrastructure, upgrading the appropriate infrastructure as is a priority according to the people, and that's water projects.
Aubrey Betancourt is with us today on Valley Public Radio. She's with the group that is helping to push a proposed ballot measure that could go before voters in the fall that could reshape the bond funds already approved by voters, both in the last water bond and also the ones approved in 2008 for high-speed rail. You're also making another change as part of this ballot measure, and that would deal with the issue of water rights, kind of a complicated topic, a legal topic, but it's one of those that is a really important one. Why the necessity to touch something that people on so many sides of the issue have always sort of treated as Pandora's box. You know, you don't want to mess with water rights. I've heard that time and time again from people in a variety of different camps. Why the necessity to go to that change right now and changing the way beneficial use is defined in the state?
Well, I'm going to have to correct you there, actually. I'm sorry, but you actually correctly stated the issue there in that second part. This does not change water rights in any way. What it does do is establish what was in our water code for 80 years, and that is a clear delineation of beneficial use and definition of beneficial use within the constitution of our state. So what this initiative does is it amends the state constitution to reestablish that the priority of beneficial use is first to domestic, second to irrigation, so people first, and thirdly to all other uses. And this goes back to addressing two issues, one being that nowhere in the Constitution is water for people protected. And secondly, nowhere in Prop 1 did it require drinking water be considered a beneficial use. And this goes back to providing that clarity in how we prioritize our water. Water rights stay completely protected in this initiative, and it's actually stated twice in the initiative that all existing water rights structures are protected and that this new initiative is completely subservient to existing water rights structures. And that's important just as what you said. It is the foundation and bedrock of our water supply is that structure of environment of existing water rights. But again, this goes to once water rights are administered, what is the highest priority of use? And we see that currently in our drought. Unfortunately, our water code that used to direct what was the highest priority of use to our state and of our water supply, that's been completely fuddled and muddied by litigation and legislation and regulation, so that now even in a drought, you've got competing beneficial uses that take top priority, where you've got one protected species that takes priority over another protected species, even though they're both equally protected according to beneficial use. But in the meantime, there's a million people without water in California. East Porterville, for instance, is a great example. And this goes back to providing that clarity of, no, the first priority of beneficial use of water is for people first. But again, you couldn't make a change like that in our Constitution today without expanding our water supply. And that is why this initiative gets our priority state straight with regards to what is the top beneficial use and priority of use of our water, providing it for our people. But it also expands our water supply by moving those funds over from high-speed rail to build specific water projects so that we provide more water for all our water users. The breakdown of water will remain the same. 50% of the water supply will still go to environmental protection, 40% to agricultural, and 10% for domestic and irrigation. The difference is they're all going to get a larger portion, and they're going to be served in a different order.
There's also some critics of this initiative from the agriculture side. You have the Nisei Farmers League, Manuel Cunha, here in this part of Central California. Also, rice growers from Northern California that are expressing some doubts about this project. They say they're concerned how it would affect their ability to flood their fields and provide wildlife habitat. And Manuel has mentioned that he's concerned that this could delay the water bond process. Where are they wrong in their analysis?
Well, with regards to water available for flooding fields, under our initiative, that would still be available. In fact, it would be a higher beneficial use under our initiative. So that's still available to them. With regards to the timeline, if you look at, again, the timeline of Prop 1, they're still currently, the California Water Commission is still just creating its rules by which it will vet projects. And it doesn't have to have those rules finalized until December of 2016. And then in 2017, they will accept applications for projects that $2.7 billion could be used for. And then in 2018, by law, they're allowed to issue the funds. Under our initiative, the funds are transferred over immediately. Should any projects be pre-approved by the commission for any reason, there's a grandfather clause that allows those projects to be grandfathered over with all of their progress being pre-approved and access to more funding to fulfill the project. And more importantly, our administrative body has to be in place by March of 2017, so almost upon passage. So the way we look at the two timelines is you'll either stay on the same timeline, which is why we put that grandfather clause in there so that we don't lose time and progress that's already been made by so many, like Manuel, who's worked hard on these projects. But more importantly, could even speed it up if the process allows. So that's kind of how we compare the two there. We did everything we could, especially with that grandfather clause, to allow for progress not to be lost, but to be rapidly transferred over so that we fully fund these projects at no new cost to our people of California.
Aubrey, before we go, a lot of people here in Central California probably are interested in this sort of a change to California's water system. But, you know, the Central Valley is politically outnumbered by the larger metropolitan parts of the state. Certainly the Bay Area has a different view on a lot of things. The environment's a much bigger concern to them. And there's a lot of people there who see San Joaquin Valley agriculture as something they want to see go away or at least be radically reshaped with new priorities for endangered species, things like that. How do you build a coalition? Because this is a statewide project. How do you realistically build the type of coalition that can get something like this passed in areas like San Francisco and L.A.?
Well, I think we're already seeing that as we've been out in the field and developing the coalition of support to garner the signatures to get this on the ballot. And the way that we've been able to do that is through common sense. Environmental stakeholders, agricultural stakeholders, business stakeholders, property owners, urban and rural have all looked at this and said this makes too much sense. It's about getting our priorities straight. It's about providing enough water for all of our uses. Under our initiative, the environment will get 2.5 million acre-feet of new water. That's more water today than it would have ever had before. Under our initiative, all existing federal environmental protections are staying in place. And so we actually have garnered a lot of support out of some of the conservation communities and environmental communities as well. In the business community, you know, everybody's kind of just fed up. The priorities that are being pushed through with regards to, you know, if you look at what are the top priorities when it comes to infrastructure development in the state among the voters of California, water and water infrastructure is number one for a second year in a row at 76%, according to Stanford University. And unfortunately, the bullet train has been number two, has been number 21 for 2 years in a row. And so this goes back to, again, this common sense mentality of we need to get our priorities straight, invest in the technology that we know is out there, and invest in the infrastructure we know we need so that we can afford something like a bullet train down the line.
Aubrey Betancourt is the executive director of the California Water Alliance, a group that is helping to gather signatures to put a ballot initiative before voters in November that would take funds from the bullet train project that were already approved by voters, direct them to water storage projects, as well as modifying the water bond that voters passed 2 years ago, also funding those water storage projects. Aubrey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's always an exciting time for local theater in the San Joaquin Valley, but there's been some new announcements on that front. New productions as well. Here to tell us more is Donald Monroe. He's the arts reporter and theater critic for the Fresno Bee. Donald, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with some of the things that are going on right now before we get to the big Broadway and Fresno announcements and some of the other things that are coming later in 2016. You wrote a really rave review about The Glass Menagerie, which is right now in production at Second Space Theater in the Tower District. Why are you such a big fan of this production?
You know, I thought it was really a fine production. J. Daniel Herring is the director, and he was able to do a production that is restrained and quiet, and yet one of the most powerful versions of this show that I've ever seen. And Amelia Ryan, who portrays the lead character, is just terrific.
And this is a classic Tennessee Williams
Absolutely
play.
Classic. If you haven't seen it, this is the production to see, I think.
One of your favorites in the last year or so?
It's definitely one of my favorites of the year. It is just really well directed, has a great ensemble cast. Stephen Weatherby and Alyssa Gaynor are really great in the supporting roles. And I just think it really captures what Williams was trying to do without the histrionics that we so often associate with that title.
What are some of the other productions either playing currently or recently that have sort of caught your eye?
Well, you know, Good Company is on a roll right now. I just saw The Little Mermaid, and I'm actually kind of scooping myself because the review has not posted, but they do a terrific job in terms of costume, scenic design, really some creative things that happen on that small stage. I mean, we all know that Roger Rockus is not a big Broadway house, and they have to figure out innovative ways to make things work in that very small space. And this show visually is just a delight.
There's also the big national touring companies that come to town. The Broadway in Fresno series down at the Sorian Theater brings a number of programs. Ragtime was just there. You saw that show. What was your take on that touring production?
I thought Ragtime was a solid production. I don't think it was quite as strong as some of the national tours that I've seen in terms of vocals. But emotionally, that show just means so much right now. It's actually a reminder that things haven't really changed in 110 years. It's like you're dealing with issues like racism and immigration and economic inequality and all those kind of buzzwords that we're using today. Now, the sound in the show, like many of the shows that come through the Sorian, was just kind of so-so. I remind people that the Sorian doesn't actually come with a sound system. The tour that comes in has to bring in its sound engineers and figure out a sound design for it. Some are more successful than others.
Is that uncommon for a theater of that size with those sorts of productions?
From what I gather, most of the time these national tours come in and they don't use the house system. They have to design their own. And it does work at the Sorian. I mean, if you saw Wicked, they brought in a killer sound system and were able to make that show work. So it can be done. It's just a little tricky.
And I imagine it's tricky going into a new house. You're only there for a few days.
Absolutely. It's got to be one of the hardest jobs in the sound design business.
So speaking of shows that are coming there, there are new shows that have just been announced for this next season, 2016 into 2017. It's amazing we're talking about
exactly
2017 already. But what can theater goers expect touring productions coming to town?
Well, you know, next season is not quite as exciting as this season. We do have Phantom of the Opera, which is coming in October, but that's actually technically part of this season.
Okay.
And then they just made an announcement for the next season. We got shows like Dirty Dancing. So, you know,
not
maybe
quite Wicked.
Maybe not quite Wicked. I'm still waiting for The Lion King. I think that would be the big, huge Broadway show that has not made it here yet.
Given that Wicked did so well when it was here, was that a signal to the industry that this market can support it? Or is Wicked just such an outlier? You know, now you're talking about Hollywood adaptation and everything.
I think it's a great sign that they were able to bring in Phantom just after Wicked, because they know that this market can support basically a two-week run, a sit-down two-week run for a musical. And so I think that's a good sign.
That was certainly a historic occasion. Before we go, other local productions that are coming to town, or not so much coming to town, but produced by locals.
Yeah. You know, one that I wanted to highlight is a show at Fresno State that's called Blue Willow, and that is an original play, and that opens May 6th. And it's pretty much like the Valley's Grapes of Wrath, is how it's just been described to me. It's about two migrant families that come to the Valley. It's set in the Great Depression, but it sort of tells the story of that time locally. And J. Daniel Herring, one of my favorite directors, is also directing that, and I have high hopes for it. I think it'll be really intriguing.
Well, we'll look forward to that at Fresno State and all of these productions that come throughout the Valley. Donald Monroe, you can read his commentary in the Fresno Bee. He's the theater critic and arts reporter for the Bee. You can find him online at fresnobee.com. Donald, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email. We are talk@kvpr.org. On Twitter, we are @kvpr@Valley Edition. And you can find our podcasts, audio archives, and more at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.